training realism with moulage, following up on athletes and concussions, and responding to patient complaints. Plus, we're going to visit again with our good friend Lisa Booz from the Maryland Poison Center. If that's what you've been looking for, well, you found it right here on the MedicCast.
Transmitters? We don't need no stinking transmitters.
This is the MedicCast, a podcast for EMS providers by EMS providers, featuring EMS news, products, tips, tricks, and commentary. So grab your gear and glove up. Here's today's show with the pod medic, Jamie Davis.
Well, good day and welcome to this week's episode of the MedicCast. I'm your host, Jamie Davis, the pod medic, and I'd like to welcome all of you to the program this week. We have a great show coming up for you. We're going to be looking at creating training realism using makeup and moulage to make it more realistic to what we see in the field. We're going to look at how we respond to patient complaints, both as individuals and as supervisors and managers. And then we're going to revisit during our tip of the week this week with our good friend Lisa Booz with a tox tidbit from the Maryland Poison Center. All of that coming up for you later on in this episode. Before we get to all of that, I do want to remind you to follow up on all of the information you find in this episode and every other episode over at the MedicCast blog. That's found at mediccast.com/blog. When you get over there, you'll find all of the information that you talk about, I talk about in these episodes, the news items, the tip of the week, additional resources to follow up on for those, all available over there under the show notes link at the top of the page, and you can find all of that information for yourself. If you want to get back in touch with me, I urge you to do so. I love to hear from you, and I do respond back to every email that comes in, so keep them coming. You can respond back to me by email at podmedic@mac.com. Send me your comments, your suggestions, your information and links for future episodes. Maybe there's a news item you'd like me to cover. Whatever the case may be, get back in touch with me and let me know what you want to see more of here on the show. That's important. You're part of this community, and it is a community effort. I can't do this alone, folks. I really encourage all of you to be active participants. There'll be some more contact information and follow-up information later on in this episode, but we should probably think about heading on into this week's news item. First up in the news this week is an interesting article I found over at emsworld.com, and it's not really a news item, it's more of a how-to link, but I found it interesting, and emsworld.com and other sites out there post these kind of how-to informational links all the time. This is a link on how to create blisters, large blood-filled blisters for use in assessing patients, managing patients with chemical burns or electrical burns or things like that, somebody that you need to manage and assess accurately. And one of the things that we don't do enough of when we train is utilize resources like moulage and makeup and helping the patient, the live patient we're assessing, seem more realistic to us so that we can know what we're assessing, find something that looks unusual. There's kits out there, there's training programs and classes out there, and this is one of those things that I would urge you to look into, especially if you like that kind of thing. Maybe you have a background in theater in your community or something like that. This is a great way to bring that to the training realm and help improve the way we prepare for actual emergencies. And one of the things we can do to do that is to make our practice patients look more realistic so that we're more prepared for when we see the real thing. Just a great article, and I urge you to follow up on it. There's just some really neat tips along this whole line that they have in there at emsworld.com, and you can find all of that over there. Lots of different things. They have it, call it the wound of the month, and it's different moulage techniques on how to create the makeup that will help your patients be more realistic if you're an educator or if you're helping an educator with a training project. One of the things that has always concerned me about EMS is how we are not involved too much in the aftermath of treating our patients, and aftermath in both a good and a negative way. We don't know often what happens to our patients after we take them to the hospital. Let's say we have a young athlete involved in a football game or a lacrosse game. They've received a concussion or what is looks to be a concussion, some kind of brain injury, even a minor brain injury, and they are going to be taken to the hospital. We take them in, we drop them off, we have no idea what happens. I just thought I'd point out to you that there's a lot of things going on out there innovating the ways we can help these patients recover and help assess them so that they know when they're able to return to normal activities. And that's important for these young athletes because they want to get back on the playing field. How soon is too soon, and how do they know when it's too soon? One of the things that this article points out is that there's actually a study that looked at how to assess patients who've been diagnosed with a concussion from a sports injury, how to reassess them and provide a follow-up assessment that says, yeah, you're now okay to go back to your sport and that participate in normal activity. That's an important thing for these people in returning them to health. And it's something that, you know, we may not always know what's going on. Is this being adequately done in your community? And is it something that can be managed? Especially if you're in a rural area and not near specialists, sometimes people skip this step, and if your school is not on top of it, they may not always check back to see if they got a doctor's note saying the student can return to activity. But there is hope. There's evidence that even a simple telehealth call, and that means, you know, a call with a nurse or a physician over a phone line to do an assessment with someone else in the room and talk to the patient, interact with the patient, and ask some key questions to find out if there's anything that needs follow-up care or if the patient is indeed recovered from the event and can return to normal activity. And the study points out that this can be done accurately and effectively over a phone call. Now, this might be something that involves another healthcare professional being in the room and being able to answer some of the questions on assessment, perhaps pupil reaction, things like that. While this normally might be undertaken by a nurse, this could also be a great opportunity for community paramedicine, for that opportunity for paramedics to use assessment skills they already have to assist in managing patients that aren't emergency patients, but are patients that need to be assessed in some way or another for their health. And we usually think about that with elderly patients, with homebound patients, but this could equally be achieved with young, otherwise healthy patients returning to work after an injury, or somebody at a workplace returning to work after an injury. And perhaps paramedics in areas that are not well served by nurses could achieve this, and it may be a way that we can be involved actively in prevention, because if we help identify those patients that aren't ready to go back to work, help identify those patients that have some kind of accessible problem after the fact, we can then help them get the follow-up care they need more efficiently and ultimately help them get back to work or their activities even faster. So I urge you to follow up on this. This type of community-based medicine and community-based EMS is going to be more and more important as we move forward. I think last week we talked a little bit about the changes in healthcare reform affecting EMS and affecting what we do. One of the things we're going to have to become better at doing is providing that kind of community-based care for our patients. If you work long enough in EMS, there's likely to be a situation that crops up where you or someone you work with receives a complaint from a patient or a patient's family member, someone in the field. How do you respond back to those complaints? And is there a way, if you're a supervisor or in charge of these other individuals, how do you manage that and refer that along without making the situation any worse? Often these are complaints that people are very angry. Perhaps the treatment was inappropriate. Perhaps it was just an inappropriate comment. Perhaps somebody stole something. Whatever the case may be, how you handle that complaint early on in the process can have a huge effect on how it affects the rest of your organization. Perhaps the person is guilty of doing something wrong or having made a medical treatment error. But how you handle it and your professionalism in dealing with the initial complaint from those individuals can go a long way towards improving the way they look at your whole organization, so that a single EMT or paramedic's actions don't reflect on all of us as much. I mean, there's going to be some reflection back, and that's just the nature of things. But how your organization manages complaints and deals with the complainants is ultimately going to affect the way they think of all of you. And hopefully they come back in a way with it, with a, some kind of a positive reaction to the experience. Maybe not completely positive, but some aspect of it being positive, that they felt like their needs were met, like they were heard. There's a great article I found at emsworld.com by author Stephen Gilbert, talking about how to take down complaint information. It's not just getting the person's name and contact information. It really is about how you respond to them from the very beginning. Not admitting any kind of guilt, not admitting any kind of wrongdoing, but interacting with these patients in such a way that, or these patients or their caregivers or the public in such a way that they know that their complaint is being heard and that it's going to be passed on up the chain. Of course, if you're a manager or supervisor yourself, how you handle that once it gets given to you is another whole aspect, and this article deals with that, responding back to people. When it's appropriate to get that information immediately, as soon as possible, and when it might be appropriate to wait a day or so, such as the case when there's been a death involved. We need to give that person a little bit of time to grieve before we come back and get the full information on the complaint. All that's in this article. I urge you to follow up on it. You know, there are resources like this out there. If you're thinking about moving on in your career in EMS, wanting to become a field training officer, a supervisor of some sort, a manager, progressing on to become a chief of a department someday, this is the kind of information you need to be reading about. And I point this out because there are resources like this out there all over the place. So I hope you continue to follow up. And of course, I'll continue to cover things like this here at the MedicCast as well. Time now for this week's tip of the week. And I'm really excited to be joined again this week by our good friend Lisa Booz from the Maryland Poison Center. I got a chance to sit down over a phone call with her a week or so ago and get some information from her for this week's Tox Tidbit segment, a little toxicology look on a specific item that Lisa brings to us. And I'm looking forward to sharing that recorded conversation with you here on the show. Welcome back to another Tox Tidbit segment with our good friend Lisa Booz from the Maryland Poison Center. Lisa is back with another toxicology segment for us. Hi, Lisa. It's good to have you back on the show.
Hi, Jamie. It's good being back. Thanks for inviting me to go over some topics.
Now, what do we have this time around?
Well, what I'd like to talk about are laundry detergent pod poisonings, and I think probably most of the listeners are familiar with this new mechanism of getting laundry detergent in your washers, but we were seeing some problems with them. So I thought I'd give you a little more information about these laundry detergents.
Well, that would be great. I know that's been in the news in recent months, and concerns about poisoning with children. It looks like candy, I guess, and I'm sure that's something you guys have been hearing about.
Right. We have, and unfortunately, there are a number of cases that have been reported, and I'll talk about a few of them, but a number of cases that have been reported that have some serious effects, and we weren't really expecting that. So, I think everybody should be on the lookout for these cases.
Okay, well, let's go ahead and see what you have to say.
Okay. Well, when we look at household cleaning products in general, they're very commonly involved in childhood poisonings. And looking at Poison Center data in 2010, there were more than 180,000 cases of cleaning product exposures reported to poison centers in the United States. And more than 8,000 of those involved laundry detergents in one form or another, whether it's powder or liquid or these detergent pods. These concentrated laundry detergent pods have actually been sold in Europe for the past 10 years, but they just came on the market in the United States in around 2010 or so. The products are single dose packs, and they contain very concentrated liquid detergent. The detergent is actually contained in a very thin, water-soluble membrane And if you handle them, you can feel that they're kind of sticky as it gets a little bit wet, and they dissolve very rapidly when they're in contact with water in the washing machine. There are a lot of different brands. Tide is a good example, All, Purex, but there are several different brands out there with these detergent pods, and they all look a little bit different from each other. Unfortunately, we have seen a number of cases of severe poisonings, and this is seen especially in small children who bite into the pods and swallow the liquid detergent. Now, the traditional laundry detergents contain various soaps and other types of compounds, and they predominantly cause nausea and vomiting when ingested. And most of the cases that we hear about it at poison centers, when children drink the laundry detergents or either liquid or they swallow some of the powder laundry detergents, usually they don't require any treatment. Usually they have a little vomiting, a little nausea maybe, and that's pretty much it. But based on some data from the European countries where they've been using these pods for a number of years, and then some recent cases here in the United States, these laundry detergent pods seem to be associated with some adverse effects more often than with the traditional sort of non-pod laundry detergents. So on May 17th of 2012, the American Association of Poison Control Centers released an alert after hearing about some cases in the United States of small children that required hospitalization after biting into the pods or swallowing some of the liquid that were in the pods. And I thought I'd just kind of briefly mention four of the cases that have been reported to poison centers. The first one was 10 minutes after a 20-month-old swallowed the laundry detergent from a pod, the child started vomiting and subsequently developed some respiratory distress. The child became unresponsive and also experienced some seizure-like activity. So he was intubated. They got a chest x-ray on him that showed some pulmonary infiltrates, and he actually did fine. He improved and was discharged 36 hours later. The second case was a 15-month-old who bit into a pack of the laundry detergent and swallowed a mouthful, and he had some profuse vomiting, and he became very lethargic. He also required intubation for airway protection, but he recovered also very rapidly and was discharged 24 hours after the ingestion. The third is a 17-month-old that bit into a packet, and he also started vomiting soon after he ingested the contents, and he rapidly developed some drowsiness and some respiratory distress, and he required intubation for a day. He also had some trouble swallowing, and that required nasogastric feedings, and once he was discharged, it also required some outpatient follow-up. He didn't have outright burns, but he did have some irritation and some problems swallowing from the concentrated detergent. And the fourth case was a 10-month-old girl that was brought to a local healthcare facility with vomiting and difficulty breathing and drooling after biting into a laundry detergent pod. She experienced some respiratory distress, and she was found to have some swelling of the epiglottis and underwent emergency endoscopy. She didn't need to be intubated, but she did have some difficulty swallowing for a pretty extended period of time. So those are four examples of some of the cases that we're hearing about that are of concern. Calls to poison centers involving these laundry detergent pods then were tracked for 1 month from the date of that alert. So we tracked cases across the country from May 17th of 2012 to June 17th of 2012, and the results were published in the Center for Disease Control and Prevention's Morbidity and Mortality Weekly report. In that one-month period, the poison centers reported 1,008 laundry detergent exposures, and of those, 48% involved the laundry detergent pods, so almost half involved the pods. 94% were children less than 5 years of age. Most were ingestions, but there were also some cases of eye and dermal exposures, and there were more cases of gastrointestinal and respiratory effects and some mental status changes with the laundry pods compared to the other detergent products. Now, for any of these pod exposures, the treatment really just consists of supportive care, especially respiratory support if they are having some respiratory difficulty. Now, why does this happen? Well, we're not really sure. It really isn't clear whether the toxic effects with the laundry detergent pods are maybe due to the ingredients, or maybe due to the concentration of the ingredients, or maybe even the delivery mechanism itself. Does biting into the pod promote aspiration of the liquid by the liquid just kind of squirting out very rapidly? We're just not quite sure yet why there are problems with these products. And why are there so many exposures in small children? Well, one theory is, like you mentioned, that children might be attracted to the pods because of their colorful appearance and their size, and they might think that it looks like candy. And also, when some parents have been interviewed, they've stated that they really don't see laundry detergents as being poisons, and so they don't take care in keeping the products up out of the reach of children or locked away or places where small children can't get into them. The products are typically sold in non-child-resistant containers, and in some cases, the containers have been described as looking like cookie jars. Recently, Procter & Gamble, that's the company that makes Tide, they added a sort of a double-latch lid safety feature on the container in which the pods are sold to try to prevent childhood ingestions. And they're also working with poison centers to collect data on cases and identify the risk factors, you know, why these are occurring, and identifying the outcomes associated with the exposures to the products. So, you know, we feel that as healthcare professionals, we need to be aware that not all laundry detergent exposures are alike, and that severe effects can occur, especially with these laundry detergent pods. And we do have a responsibility to help educate those who care for small children about proper storage of detergents, and as well as other household products, not just detergents. And we should be proactive in making sure that people have the poison center telephone number readily available and even programmed into cell phones. And that number, as a reminder, is 800-222-1222. And then lastly, it's important for healthcare providers, when confronted with exposures, to report these exposures to your poison center so that we can continue to collect data on these products to better understand why the poisonings are occurring and why they're having these more severe effects.
Yeah, it's part of our prevention mandate, you know, that all healthcare professionals have in some part of their education and their training is we're supposed to be actively involved in preventative measures. And this is one of them is educating the public about the dangers of household cleaning products. And that includes laundry cleaners.
That's right. That's right. And, you know, I think people just aren't familiar with what a poison actually is, you know, and what products they need to be careful with. And also that children are very capable of getting into containers and climbing up on top of the washing machine, and they're getting into areas that they don't think would be possible. So, you know, we have a good opportunity to educate people when, you know, when EMS providers go into the home and they, you know, might see things that aren't stored properly, whether it's an exposure to one of these products or just kind of as an aside, you know, while they're there, they notice it. And then also when parents bring their kids to the emergency department, you know, it's important for emergency department staff to also educate people about poison prevention and keeping their children safe, and also having access to the poison center phone number.
And the poison center has got materials and resources available. So if a healthcare professional wants to reach out and do something in their community or talk to daycare providers in their area about safe handling or materials that they can send home to parents when they send the kids home every day, that's something that the poison centers can also provide to medical professionals in the community.
That's right. That's right. All poison centers do have educational materials, and it might be pamphlets, it might be telephone stickers, magnets with the telephone number, even as something as simple as leaving the poison center magnet on the refrigerator can speak volumes as to, you know, preventing poisonings or just making people aware that poisonings do occur and that they do have a place to call. So certainly healthcare providers can get that information, get those materials from poison centers.
Well, thank you, Lisa, for that Tox Tidbit update. And I know that's something that's been in the news and something we're likely to run into. I know I sent my son away to college to with some of those pods to make it easier for him to do laundry at school. And hopefully he won't be around any children that are going to ingest them. But we purchased them. It looked convenient. And I'm sure they're in a lot of homes out there.
Oh, they're big right now. I mean, they're very convenient. You know, you just throw one into the washer and you're done. It doesn't take measuring. It doesn't take, you know, using a cup or using something that's messy. So they're very, very popular right now.
Well, thank you, Lisa. We'll look forward to talking to you again soon.
Thanks, Jamie.
And that's going to wrap up this week's episode of the MedicCast. I want to thank everybody for checking out the show this week and urge you to follow up on all of the information available for you over at the MedicCast website. You'll find that at mediccast.com/blog. When you get over there, there's a link for show notes right at the top of the page. When you click that link, you can find all of the episodes going all the way back to episode 1 if you want to scroll down and go back far enough. There's information there on all the news items discussed in each episode, as well as all of the information and additional resources on each week's tip of the week. And it's your job to follow up on those additional resources. Look at your own protocols and make sure you understand how things I talk about here on the show apply or don't apply to your own scope of practice. So please make sure you follow up on that information. If you want to get back in touch with me, I'd love to hear from you. Send emails in to me here, podmedic@mac.com. I want to hear from you, and I do respond back to every email that comes in, and I share some of those emails here on the show. So keep those emails coming with your comments, your suggestions, corrections, or information you'd like to share with the other members of the MedicCast community. If you want to follow up with me on social media sites, you can usually find me under the handle PodMedic. So twitter.com/PodMedic or facebook.com/PodMedic, things like that. And of course, don't be afraid to head on over to the MedicCast fan page and become a fan of the MedicCast on Facebook. That's at facebook.com/MedicCast. And when you get there, you'll actually find a like button at the top of the page, click that like button, and then there are additional articles, resources, videos, and other things I post over there that may not come out here on the weekly show, but you'll be able to find those resources over there on the MedicCast page. And one of the things you can do over on Facebook is comment, click the like button on an article, and if you're already a fan, that's a great way to share and expand the reach of the MedicCast community to other people you know. So don't be afraid to like something, don't be afraid to comment on something, and start a dialogue with some of the other members of the MedicCast community about a given article. I try to answer back whenever someone comments, and it's important for us to continue that discussion and maybe find a future interesting tip or article segment for a future MedicCast episode. I look forward to hearing from you over there. That's it. We'll go ahead and close out this episode of the MedicCast. I will remind you, I'm Jamie Davis, the Pod Medic. I'll be back here every week on Monday with another MedicCast episode. And in the meantime, I want you to remember, Scene Safety and BSI.